Hi, everyone. Welcome to the XYZ Experiment podcast. Today on the podcast, you have your hosts, myself, Dash and Fiona, and we have a guest with us who I'm going to introduce shortly. But today we're going to talk about work and management and workplace relations. So there's a lot to unpack there. Our guest today is Professor Greg Bamber, and Greg is a distinguished professor, in the Department of Management at Monash Business School. He is also the co-director for the International Consortium for Research in Employment and Work and the research theme lead for Future of Work at Monash AI Institute, amongst many other roles and responsibilities, which we will hear about, I'm sure, throughout this episode. So welcome to the podcast, Greg.
Well, thank you, Dash. Having listened to many eps of your world-famous podcast, I'm honoured that you've invited me. I'm a POM, but also an Aussie, having lived in Australia for a long time, but have also served as a visitor at leading unis in the UK, Europe, North and South America, Asia, and Africa. I was recruited to come to Australia by the University of Queensland. So I moved from the UK as a mid-career academic, having subsequently been headhunted by Monash Uni. I now live in inner city Melbourne, but have also been lucky enough to visit many other countries around the world in connection with my work, including France, Italy, China, India, Canada, the US, and lots more, and have been an academic in industrial or workplace relations, human resource management, and workplace technological changes, including artificial intelligence or AI, for several decades.
We ask all of our guests, what generation do you belong to?
Well, to use your terms, I'd be seen as a boomer, having been born in the post-Second World War boom and was a teenager and young adult in the 60s and 70s. In my teens, I had a big motorbike and developed an early interest in civil liberties, students' rights, workers' rights and human rights more generally. My parents were at the end of the so-called greatest generation, typically defined as those born between about 1900 and 1927. They were both in the army during the war. They had two boys, with me as the eldest. And I've got a Gen X son and a Gen Y daughter, Alex and Kate. They're each on the cusp of their generations. I don't see them as belonging to different generations, but what do you call such people who are on the cusp?
Well, they do have odd names, and I'm also on the cusp. So sometimes, as a millennial, I am considered a geriatric millennial.
Oh, no.
I know that's the mean way of saying it, or a zennial is the other one, because I do have a bit of Gen X traits. That might be your kid's cusp term.
Okay.
Yeah.
What is the most boomer thing about you?
Well, I still listen to music from the 1960s, the Beatles and the Rolling Stones. I appreciate reading the mainstream media and listen to the wireless or the radio, free-to-air TV. I'm still reading serious newspapers, preferably ones that are independent. I've got a strong work ethic, typical of some, but not all boomers. My kids say that I'm a workaholic. And I still enjoy Monty Python-esque comedy. But I recently enjoyed the newish biopic about Bob Dylan called A Complete Unknown.
Have you just seen that? Yes. Have you seen it?
I haven't, but I heard it's superb.
It's really good.
Worth having a look at.
Yeah. Greg, you did touch on this and very curious about, you talking about your interest right from the start in student unions and, you know, workplace kind of justice and all of that kind of stuff as a young person. But what sparked your interest in work and workplace relations? How did you get into this?
Well, before becoming an academic, I was lucky enough to have experience of many different mostly short-term jobs, including as a gravedigger, a golf caddy, a construction worker, a petrol service station manager, a farm worker, a factory worker, supermarket shelf stacker, and as a public servant and a trade union official. And such diverse experiences sparked my interest in work and workplace relations, but it was fueled by an influential mentor when I was an undergrad at Manchester Uni in the UK. And having been fortunate to get invited to visit many countries for work and have experience of lots of different industries in a research capacity, apart from those mentioned, for example, in chemicals, electronics, logistics, engineering, finance, healthcare, hospitality, infrastructure, steel, mining, railways and transport, telecommunications, and in a range of enterprises in Australia, the UK, and overseas. But my most recent research has focused on hospitals and aviation, as well as higher education.
Mm.
And before we brought you onto this podcast, I had a good look at you online to see what you're doing. And looking at your Monash University profile, you also have a range of current and past external positions. Could you mention a few of them for us?
Well, I'm the State of Victoria co-convener for the Fellows of the Academy of the Social Sciences in Australia, and co-chair of the international section of the Labour and Employment Relations Association from the US, and I'm an associate fellow for the Digital Futures at Work Research Centre, or DIGIT, led by four unis in the UK: Sussex, Leeds, Cambridge and Manchester. Monash is the only non-UK university that's involved. And I've been a non-exec director on some boards in health, education and sport, and an advisor to some governments and international agencies such as the International Labour Organization, part of the United Nations, based in Geneva, and have been an arbitrator and investigator in workplace disputes.
That is a pretty incredible list. And like just listening to you, I feel like you're bringing quite a spread of experience across sectors, but also internationally. I guess drawing on that, I'm wondering, do you, because we are a podcast that considers different ages and generations in the workplace, in your research or just, you know, from your observation, are there any differences between the different generations in how they approach work? And I know there's a lot of stereotypes that get thrown around. I wonder how you feel about them in terms of their context in workplace management.
Okay. Perhaps in comparison to many of my gen, my attitudes might be seen as more progressive than might be typical. For example, about feminism, equality of opportunities, climate policy. And unlike earlier gens and unlike boomers growing up in Australia, those who grew up in the UK haven't had to fight in wars. The UK was smart enough to refuse to join in the Vietnam War, for example. And I sympathise with peace movements. I'm opposed to most of the wars that have happened in my lifetime, including those in the Middle East and in Vietnam, which my Vietnamese friends call the American War.
Wow.
And perhaps unlike many in my gen, I've always been an early adopter of new technologies. And in terms of stereotypes in relation to some of the other gens you mentioned, I think they are stereotypes to some extent. My gen is typically seen as being conscientious, valuing job security, perhaps reflecting our parents' experiences who grew up in the 1930s depression. Gen X, sometimes called the MTV generation, initially were seen as slackers by older generations, but perhaps they should be seen as valuing more work-life balance. And the millennials or the Gen Yers, some of my gen stereotype them as being lazy and unreliable. I don't agree with those generalizations. I know many folks, including your good self, Darsh, who don't fit that stereotype. But maybe the younger generations are less inclined to follow traditional career paths and perhaps a bit more focused on work-life balance. And they may have had different jobs or careers during their working life to a greater extent than older generations. And then the Gen Zers, those between about 13 and 27 currently, maybe it's too early to comment on their work attitudes because many of them are still in full-time education, including many of our students at Monash Uni. And am I allowed to mention I've got a couple of Gen Zers in my extended family?
Yes, absolutely.
Luca and Coco, for example, one of them got into her preferred unis but decided to defer until she was sure about what she wanted to study. And also perhaps a factor is that higher education is now seen as a huge investment, not only in terms of time, but also in terms of getting into debt. So instead of going straight on to uni, she's currently working from home as a social media consultant, trying to develop her own business. And Gen Zers may be the first gen in Australia to have grown up with widespread access to the internet and digital devices. So some call them digital natives.
Yeah.
Maybe along with the subsequent Gen Alpha.
Alphas, yeah. Mm.
And whereas boomers grew up before the digital age. So we're sometimes seen as people who are more likely to struggle with technologies.
Do you think that's fair?
Well, it may be applicable to some people, but not all people. So I've, as I mentioned, always been an early adopter. To what extent are these stereotypes useful in terms of workplace management? Well, it's good to be accommodating of other people's work attitudes and approaches. But all stereotypes may include some overgeneralization and can lead to discrimination or to managers and co-workers making the wrong assumptions about people.
Yeah.
Yeah, like I'm not going to employ a Gen Z. I've seen that all over the internet, which is crazy.
Well, that's exactly right. And there are several instances where recruiters have advertised for a so-called, in quotes, digital native to apply for a job, as opposed to requesting applicants with a specific set of skills that a person of any age could possess. And some such recruiters have been found guilty of age discrimination. So these gen differences are stereotypes. Over the ages, older generations tend to think that younger generations are lazy. As George Bernard Shaw famously put it, youth is wasted on the young. And younger generations tend to think that older gens are out of touch and that they should be put out to pasture and there are better ways to do things. But as each gen gets older, their values, their politics, their priorities may change. And we should keep in mind also George Orwell's astute observation. In quotes, each generation imagines itself to be more intelligent than the one that went before it and wiser than the one that comes after it. And these gen differences have long spans, 15 or 20 years. So life or family stage or qualifications or experiences may impact work attitudes more specifically than which gen they belong to.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've said has really, it's just resonating, going around in my brain, is your Gen Z and your family putting off university. because of the expense, which is something I never experienced and you probably didn't experience. We got university for free. So if you wanted to change course, like you did 2 years of this and thought, oh, no, I'll change now to another course, you didn't have the costs associated with that, but they do now. Now, can you offer us an example of what we were talking about earlier about the different stereotypes in the workplace?
Well, forgive me having reservations about these stereotypes. Yeah. And just to give an example, among the millennial gen, you might find a 28-year-old with no kids, and you might also find a married 44-year-old millennial with kids, and these two people may have very different goals and priorities and be at different stages in their careers. The 28-year-old may be struggling to build a career with little focus on family. By contrast, the 44-year-old might be in a well-established career and also have big responsibilities with family at home, and so some different priorities. So these gen boundaries are blurry.
Yeah.
So would you then say it's almost better to kind of consider people in terms of, you know, their life experience and life stage and what might be happening more holistically, really?
Yes, Darsh, absolutely. But I think there are other kinds of boundaries and cleavages that are also possibly even more important than generation differences. And some things that come to mind are differences of race, ethnicity, social class, education, geography, and so forth. These may be even more pervasive and need to be considered alongside generation differences. And another slight reservation about the gen definitions is that access to digital technologies may differ depending on where you live. For example, people in rural or remote areas, or compared with people in the inner city or people in some other countries, had access to digital technologies and the internet rather in advance of it becoming widespread in its availability in Australia. So forgive me on your great pod expressing some reservations about these gen stereotypes.
But this is why we are so thankful you've come on, because I think it's really important to kind of have these conversations about some of this, because it is something we do here in workplaces and in the media around these big generational divides and how they can be sometimes quite negative. And you gave some great examples about that in terms of some job advertising around digital natives. But I guess, you know, even with all of those generational differences, if we even take a step back and think about this from age diversity, how can, I guess, workplaces, employers foster collaboration in a more meaningful way, do you think?
Well, great question. We should recognise, or employers should recognise, that older and younger generations bring useful and complementary sets of knowledge and skills to workplaces. Younger gens may be more in touch with current trends and developments and popular culture and so on, but older gens have a wealth of experience and have had to adapt to different work environments and practices, so can draw on those experiences. And in my personal and work life, I'm lucky enough to interact with a lot of people who are in younger gens. I find I learn lots from many of them, despite the gen boundaries. Such boundaries shouldn't be seen as constraining interactions. In some ways, we engage in kind of bi-directional mentoring. They advise me and I try and help them in other ways. On the one hand, however, there are concerning intergenerational issues of fairness in Australia. On the other hand, we should beware of making too much of these gen differences.
So the intergenerational fairness, can you tell us a little bit more about that? What do you mean by that?
Well, on the one hand, in Australia, the tax practices and the housing market currently seem to be rather unfair for younger people. Mm. So they are ripe for reform. On the other hand, there are boundaries between groups of people that may be more significant than the gender differences, some of which I've mentioned already, and they might also include occupation, political allegiance, religion, gender, and so on. But perhaps such matters could be the subject of another podcast.
Yeah. It's a lot, I know. Are employers now more focused on employee well-being and mental health for all gens?
There have been more discussions about mental health more overtly in recent years than there used to be, including in workplaces and across the gens. Employers have a legal obligation to provide a safe and healthy workplace, including mental health. Employers' rhetoric plays lip service to fostering employee well-being and mental health. Our research shows that the realities in many workplaces are that there is conflict, toxicity, favouritism, discrimination, bullying and harassment. Many employers are fostering work intensification as there's more pressure on them to improve their financial performance and so on. Many workplaces have micromanagement and management by metrics and quantitative targets, which have absurd consequences because people chase the metric or the indicator rather than really trying to do the best job in a more holistic sense. Employers are using algorithms to manage people. There's increasing surveillance of employees using forms of AI as well as cameras. There's wage theft taking place and anti-union practices. But many employers say they're taking remedial action by offering access to employee assistance programs or EAPs. What would you think of EAPs?
Well, one thing I only just learnt about EAPs, Greg, and this is like probably showing my absolute ignorance in some of the research that we've been doing with hospitals, I always assumed, incorrectly, that the EAP was sector specific and so that they would understand, I guess, the pressure of what that person might be ringing up for support, particularly if it was around workplace mental health stuff or challenges. I only just realised it's just an umbrella service that is contracted out by all these different organisations. And so you could have someone who has no idea about the type of work you do in the workplace that you're working in. And so I don't know. Then I walked away and thinking they might not be the most helpful people to talk to.
Well, I think you're absolutely right.
I've never actually heard the term before.
Oh, they're widely used in medium to large organisations. Including universities, and they're provided by psychologists who are counsellors who provide a counselling service to employees. But my criticism of these programs is that they tend to treat the symptoms of bad workplaces, and I counsel employers instead of only treating the symptoms to invest in trying to improve bad workplaces and to foster good workplaces with better and more decent work practices and getting rid of some of those malpractices that I mentioned a moment ago. And there's much research evidence, and just to mention one name, Michael Marmot in the UK, if you've come across his work, that suggests that empowering people through control over their lives is good for their mental health and their health more generally, so that autonomy in work and life more generally fosters mental and physical health, and that jobs with little control, little autonomy and more micromanagement are particularly harmful. Safe Work Australia offers information about looking after mental health at work and protecting people from unsafe work practices and workplaces. And it's not perhaps widely known that workers can use paid leave to take a day off, which is sometimes called a mental health day, or in Australia, a Duna day.
Such an Aussie slang.
Employers and employees are getting more aware of mental health needs and practices, but perhaps there's more such awareness among younger gens than there is among the older gens. And in the post-COVID world, the remote and hybrid work options perhaps allow for better work-life balance than applied when people had to be in their workplace every day from dawn till dusk. And this may improve employee well-being and mental health. And our research at Monash suggests that most employers are willing to accommodate flexible work options more than they used to pre-COVID. And there's also an increasing focus on workers' rights to disconnect when they're not on the clock, which establish more boundaries between work and private life. So workers don't have to be compelled to answer phone calls or emails after hours. But there's an issue among students in universities, for example, who are often leaving their assignments to the last minute and will often message us at 5 to midnight when the assignment's due at the weekend and want an immediate answer or granting an extension or want advice and so on. And academics are among the occupational categories that perhaps are expected to answer messages and emails like that after hours, even though they're not coming directly from their employer, but from the students in our case, as you would know, Dash.
Yeah, yeah.
Can I ask, do you answer those emails? I mean, I'd be asleep at that time of night. Like, what happens with that?
Well, initially I was silly enough that I did answer those sorts of emails, wanting to give the best possible response to students and thinking about students' interests. But more recently, I've been saying to students at the start of the semester, please recognise that we all need some work-life balance and plan your work ahead so that you're not expecting a last-minute answer over the weekend.
Yeah.
So I've been trying to share with students that it's not always reasonable to expect responses 24/7.
Yeah.
But it comes back to what Greg was talking about before in terms of sometimes we have these metrics that we work to, and student evaluations is one of them, right, for academics. And so there's this pressure that if you don't do what the student wants, which might be respond at midnight to an email to grant them an extension, then you're going to get poor student evaluations, which might then impact on your promotions abilities or, you know, other things that might be happening in an academic workplace. So it's a very tricky balancing act.
That's crazy. I didn't know that. Okay.
Well, you're absolutely right, Dash. And it's even more challenging if you're employed only on a sessional basis, on a weekly or a semester basis. And if you're not getting the best student evals, you may worry that you're not going to be employed again the following semester or the following period when people are re-employed. So there's quite a pressure, and it's not only in academia. We see this for food delivery drivers out here who are pressurized to be delivering the food very fast, even if that means running through a red light or going up a one-way street in the wrong direction so they can deliver their food on schedule. Otherwise, they're maybe not going to be continued on the app for the food delivery company and so on. So there are quite a lot of unanticipated consequences of not only student evaluations but customer evaluations in a whole range of areas, not So it's not pressure that's only coming directly from employers, but indirectly from customers or students or patients in hospitals and so forth.
It's why I so rarely take Uber, because I don't want to be rated. Like, I'm polite to the driver every single time. Like, I really respect them, but I don't want to be rated.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Yeah.
It's just, I would give everybody 5 stars, but yeah, it's crazy.
Well, it's putting more and more pressure on people who are employed in the so-called gig economy or in similar contexts. Mm.
You touched on COVID and workplace culture since then. I sometimes wonder if the world was headed towards a difference in the workplace or whether, and COVID just accelerated that. Have hybrid and remote models improved or hindered productivity and engagement?
Well, flexible work options help to accommodate a wider variety of people's needs. People may have caring responsibilities at home, for example. So I think COVID helped to bring that to the fore when people suddenly had to pivot almost overnight to working remotely from having been fixed in their workplace, although we should recognise that not everyone can work remotely.
Mm.
We do research in the aviation industry, for example, and other forms of public transport, and you can't work in aviation or transport remotely. You can't fly the plane or manage the air traffic control or load the bags and all of those sorts of jobs.
I can't work remotely as a dentist.
Remotely, well, that's right. And it was clear in the 2025 Australian federal election that people value flexible work options. And if you remember when the coalition announced a policy to reduce working from home and get people back in the office, particularly in the Australian public service, and by implication in other workplaces, there was an immediate backlash. Yeah. So the coalition straight away reversed that policy. But flexible work options can have many benefits, including you spend less time on commuting, you've got more autonomy, perhaps having a more relaxed work environment. You can have more opportunity for engaging in walking meetings on the phone or in person, which are better for your mental and physical health. You can have breaks that are more rejuvenating. You can do some care work in breaks in your employed work, if you like. So you can give a little better work-life balance and, in some contexts, increased productivity, but that doesn't apply in all contexts. But there are also some disadvantages or some downsides. And to bring back the Jen question a moment, I think that having lots of remote working can be disadvantageous for the younger generations because they've then got fewer opportunities for learning informally from the more experienced colleagues. And much learning takes place in what we call water cooler moments or in the lunch break or in the corridor when people are asking for a bit of informal advice, which is harder to do if you're working online. And also working from home can be challenging if you've got kids running in and out of your home office. It can perhaps lead to a reduced sense of teamwork and possibly more loneliness or feelings of isolation.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. And, you know, I've got a few team members on my team who their whole university degree was online because of COVID. Mm. And then the first couple of years of work have been remote. And, you know, you kind of think, well, they've lost those formative years of engagement in a team environment and in a workplace environment, which can be really helpful as you go in your career. Mm. So,
and fun.
And fun.
Yeah, and fun.
Yeah. One of the things I am very excited about what you do, because I've started collaborating with the Monash AI Institute, I will say, is that you are a theme lead on the future of work, and wondering if you can touch on artificial intelligence and how it's being used in recruitment, and what are some of the benefits or maybe some of the harms also associated with that?
Well, many recruiters are faced with a huge pile of resumes or job applications, and they are using AI for scanning and ranking resumes, using keywords or key indicators about experience and qualifications. Some people, when they apply for jobs, are having to record a little vidcast and submit that.
Oh, God.
And some recruiters are using AI to analyze your facial expressions, your tone of voice, your word choice during these recorded interviews. And the benefits can be that these busy recruiters can spend less time on sifting through a pile of applications, and they can get on with aspects of their job that they find more interesting. And it may be, if there's a large pool of applicants, that AI can be used to speed up the response to the applicants, and it applies the same criteria to all candidates.
Mm,
and it reduces perhaps the tendency for recruiters to rely on gut feeling if the AI being used in recruitment is designed well.
Because that's the thing, isn't it? I'm thinking the AI could be designed to look for a very specific style of person, which might not be what you really need. I don't know. It's a tricky one.
Well, you're absolutely right, Fiona. And research by colleagues in our Digit Research Centre based in the UK shows that there are very real risks of using AI. For example, if the large language models are trained on biased data, which many of them are, AI can perpetuate or even amplify the discrimination against certain gens, older people or younger people, women or minorities. It may lack transparency because the AI is a kind of black box. Candidates may have no sight of how the decisions are made. It may overlook qualified candidates who don't fit the algorithm's mould.
Mm.
And it can also be concerns about privacy. For example, if AI is being used to analyse these sort of video recruitment interviews. So there are lots of issues to consider, both pro and con, when using AI for making recruitment decisions. I mean, it's important to remember that there are many types of AI.
Yes.
It's a whole basket of tools, if you like. And AI can be very useful for pattern recognition, data processing and automation on the one hand, but on the other hand, it may lack empathy or moral reasoning and a sense of humour, which I know both of you have, because I hear you laughing on your on your pods.
All the time.
And such human skills continue to be crucial in roles that require trust, creativity, ethical oversight, and perhaps some humour in many fields like healthcare, education, social services, policy making, leadership, and so on.
AI is already reshaping work and industrial relations and will continue to do so in profound ways. What are some of the key areas where AI is likely to have the most significant impact?
Well, AI can be used advantageously to do the jobs that are dirty, dangerous, or drudgery. And this can free up time for more interesting work. The AI can be used to replace repetitive or predictable tasks. And this can lead to job displacement on the one hand, but on the other hand, new jobs are being created in AI development, data analysis, human-AI collaboration. And many jobs are changing to combine human skills like creativity and empathy with AI capabilities. For example, both of you are in the medical health fields, and a doctor supported by AI can make better informed decisions than a doctor can when working alone, or than AI can when working alone. So they can complement each other. In terms of industrial relations, unions who represent workers may need to negotiate about people being managed by algorithms or being subject to surveillance, and also redundancy, and also about AI being used in performance evaluation and work scheduling, where there may be concerns about bias and unfairness, especially if employers are using AI to try and track work performance, productivity, and even emotions. This raises legal and ethical sorts of questions. So workers and their unions may push back, demanding more transparency and limits on the use of surveillance technologies and data. We saw a case here in Victoria just before Christmas last year when the Woolies stores in and around the state of Victoria had empty shelves because the workforce in the warehouses were concerned that Woolies were introducing AI to be a form of surveillance over how they worked, and to make decisions about who was going to be promoted or who might lose their jobs and so on. So,
wow.
Employers and unions need to collaborate over these issues and also to foster more training to develop skills in the field of new technologies. And I could rabbit on further about these sorts of issues. Employers should lean over backwards to adopt ethical approaches to ensure the fair treatment of workers, and we may need more regulation from governments about how AI is used in life more generally, as well as in workplaces.
It's so interesting you bring up that example of Woolies, because I remember the shelves being empty but not understanding why the workers had actually gone on strike.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, that's even for the general public to understand that was the reason behind that. That's like pretty incredible.
AI was also deciding whether you can get out of the store or not after you've paid for your shopping, if the gate will open to release you, you know, or AI. I was at Woolworths in particular, and I was doing my shopping and putting everything through, and then the AI decided that something I put through wasn't correct, but it was, had to call the girl over, who then looked at the video footage of me on the camera. And because the AI said, oh, no, that's wrong. And then she looked at it and said, oh, no, it's correct, and corrected it. But the AI was busy saying I had said the wrong thing, you know, when I said, oh, it's apples and it was tomatoes or whatever it was. And that's AI.
So interesting.
And if I'd ignored it, if I'd got to the gates wouldn't let me out.
There are some shops overseas now where you don't ever put in your credit card when you check out.
Yeah.
The AI is watching what you've picked up and is automatically charging your credit card. So you just walk out of the shop when when you filled up your basket. So that's beginning to happen.
Wow. Oh, my gosh. What a world we're living in. It's so incredible. But changing tact a little bit away from AI, because we want to touch on the work you've done in the aviation industry. What can you tell us about the aviation industry? I know you've just co-authored a book, Up in the Air, How Airlines Can Improve Performance by Engaging Their Employees. And we know there's been a lot of things that have happened in the aviation industry. So, yeah, tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, our research at Monash with international colleagues concludes that airlines, and indeed most other kinds of employing organisation, can perform more effectively if they rely on inclusive decision making and give a voice to the workers, other things being equal, so that workers are involved in shaping workplace policies and changes in organisations and so on. Among the world's airlines, we find that Southwest Airlines, which is based in the US, it doesn't actually fly to Australia, but it's a very successful example of this approach of putting people first It was a successful new entrant airline in the early 1970s, even though it's faced challenges in recent years. But Southwest can be seen as a contrast with many other airlines, which seems to put short-term profits ahead of people issues, whether the people are the workers or the customers.
Mm. And I guess going back a little bit to also the AI, and, you know, you're talking about just then leadership, how do you think leadership styles do need to evolve in this new world where digital tools and AI are part of our everyday management?
Well, I would like to see leadership styles being more inclusive and more considerate of employees' voices and interests, not only in airlines, but in most other sectors and enterprises, including in universities and hospitals and retail. This is in spite of a trend which we can see in some contexts of employing organizations preaching strong leadership, in quotes, which can mean more autocratic or more top-down or more command and control forms of leadership. So I would like to see leadership being more democratic, if you like, and involving more members of the workforce rather than just being top-down.
Do you think that's happening? Do you think workplaces are recognising that?
Some are, but many workplaces are under great pressure to perform financially and to make quick decisions, to change their arrangements for supplies or manufacturing or whatever. And many of them, many of the people at the top of organizations think that they haven't got time to consult with the workforce. They haven't, they haven't got time to waste on having consultative meetings and so on. They need to get on and make decisions. But research shows that time spent consulting the workforce actually can lead to better decisions in the medium term, and decisions that are more likely to be implemented, more likely to be lasting, rather than decisions that are made quickly but without including the wisdom of the workforce, because it's the workforce at the coalface who actually know about doing the work more than those who are sitting at the top of the hierarchy or their consultants may be aware of.
The wisdom they could learn from that, that's what it is, isn't it?
Yeah, and I'm just thinking back, Emma Saddington, who's come on our pod, has taught me, and she worked in senior roles in hospitals and is now in a very senior role as well for oversight over around hospitals as well. But she uses the phrase walk the floor, and that senior management need to walk the floor to understand what's happening on the ground, and often they're very disconnected about the system of work and the ways of work if they don't take the time to actually do that.
Well, that's right, Darsh. There's another expression, management by walking around, rather than management sitting in the corner office issuing directives or making decisions. I once was invited into a very large employing organisation in Australia to advise about particular issues that they were having. And I said to the senior executive, have you been down onto the work floor and talked with the workers concerned about what the issues are? And his response to me was, no, I wouldn't get that far down the rabbit hole.
Oh,
I've got people down there, supervisors, managers. They can talk to the workers. I'm senior executive. So we went down, talked to the workers and found out what the issues were that were concerning them, which, cut a long story short, led to a great improvement in the productivity, the efficiency and effectiveness of what was happening in this particular organisation.
You have written a lot of books, can I just say? But anyway, the seventh edition of your book, International and Comparative Employment Relations, looks at research on institutions globally. How do approaches to managing people and technology differ across cultures, and what can we learn from these differences?
Well, a full answer would take a whole podcast. So suffice it to say briefly that the Nordic countries, including Denmark, Sweden, Finland, Norway, Iceland and some other countries in Northwest Europe might be seen as role models in some ways. They tend to be productive and wealthy nations that are consistently rated among the happiest in the world, with still having free education, including higher education, some of the best employee benefits, generous paid parental and family leave, flexible work options, family support such as very affordable childcare with a strong focus on work-life balance, and an acceptance that treating employees well is usually a win-win for employees and employers. These countries also have high levels of unionization and employee participation in management decision-making. And they contrast with Australia and some other liberal market economies in the English-speaking world in particular, where younger gens are much less likely to join and be represented by unions. And this may lead to what we call a representation gap, which means these unrepresented workers have less voice to their employer than if they had a union to represent them and speak up on their behalf, because an individual worker's voice is not generally heard by big organisations in particular, where there's quite an imbalance of power, if you like, between an individual and a big employing organisation.
You've done extensive research about unions and industrial relations systems around the world. Which countries have the strongest trade unions and why is that?
Well, the countries with the strongest unions, typically measured by union density, which is the percentage of workers who are union members, tend to share certain political and institutional characteristics. So right up at the top would be the Nordic countries I've just mentioned, where a majority of workers are union members. They have strong welfare states and social democratic traditions, high coverage of collective bargaining and relatively cooperative union management relations. Other countries with high union density include some of the socialist countries like Cuba, Vietnam, China, and South Africa also has a relatively high density of union membership, perhaps because unions played a powerful role there in overturning the apartheid movement, and they remain politically influential.
What are the key factors that can facilitate the strength of a union?
Well, countries like the Nordic countries, where unions typically administer unemployment benefits, and so union members can see a tangible benefit from being a union member, and other countries also provide such benefits to union members like Belgium, and these countries tend to have in government often social democratic or labour-aligned governments that support workers and union rights. They have strong laws that protect the rights of people to organise collectively and bargain collectively. They have stronger traditions of solidarity, and they often have large public sectors or strong manufacturing or mining sectors, which have often had high rates of unionisation.
This morning I actually had a conversation with my husband about the Nordic countries, and he talked about how a lot of these Nordic countries ensure that their population, everyone has a livable income. And he really admires that. But he was saying to me, how do they afford it? Like, they haven't got massive populations and things like that. How do they? Because they have good healthcare and all sorts of stuff. And he was like, how do they afford that?
Well, they have relatively high rates of tax, for example, compared with Australia, which is a relatively low tax country, in spite of people here often complaining about the levels of tax. But they also, as you say, are relatively small countries, but they invest in their people. They see education as an investment and training as an investment in people rather than as a cost to be minimised or cut, which is sometimes the mentality in Australia, I regret.
And so you've talked about countries where they've done really well in this area, but there are some countries with free unions where free unions are permitted, but they have weak unions. What are some of the weakest unionised countries and the reasons behind their relative weakness?
Well, there are lots of examples. Just to mention a couple, France, which has low union density in the single figures. So they appear to be weak on the one hand, but in spite of having low membership, the unions are still able to muster big demonstrations to support their members when they feel strongly about an issue. And they still have high coverage of collective bargaining. And one reason why the unions are weak in France is that, unlike in Australia, which has one central council of unions, the ACTU, the Australian Council of Trade Unions, in France there are multiple central councils which are partly divided on religious or ideological grounds. In the US, again, low union density, but unions are strong in some industries. But we've seen in the US a massive employer resistance, anti-union campaigns run by employers, legal consultants, especially in the southern states of the US, and a legal framework which is rather anti-union, particularly in the very recent period, and also a decline in the traditionally highly unionized sectors and companies, and a rise in the service and the gig economy, where it's very difficult to organise workers into unions because there's a high transient population of workers who are employed on a casual kind of basis, if you like.
So, Greg, thank you so much for sharing a lot of your wisdom and insights and research. We've learnt a lot from you. But we have a question around your name. Where does the name Bamba come from?
Well, originally from Germany, centuries ago, but since medieval times, it's been a common name in central Lancashire, in the northwest of England in particular, where some land was given to German people by some kind of deal between their royal families in the medieval period. And there's a village in central Lancashire called Bamber Bridge. So there are lots of Bambers around that area still.
And what can you tell us about Bamber Bridge?
Well, just as a bit of a fun fact, there was a famous Battle of Bamber Bridge, which wasn't a conventional military battle that you might think of in the Second World War. But in that period, there were two US military bases nearby. One housed African American soldiers, and the other included the American military police, or MP, who were white. And there was a confrontation between these two segregated groups in 1943 when a white MP killed a black soldier, and more MPs arrived armed with machine guns and grenades, and the black soldiers armed themselves with rifles, and the incident involved gunfire and injuries with at least one death, court-martials for some of the soldiers. But the larger impact was interesting insofar as the American MPs ordered the local pubs to impose a colour bar, because they didn't like to see the blacks and whites in the same pub. The American armed forces were still subject to a colour bar and segregated. So the next day, all the local pubs put up signs saying, "Blacks only."
I love that.
It was not what the MPs had in mind. And the event exposed deep-seated racism in the US military and led to some changes in policy, although a full desegregation took very much longer. And this mutiny, as it was censored during the war, which reminds us about the old maxim that the first casualty of war is the truth.
Yeah.
And the Battle of Bamber Bridge has been published about subsequently. There's been a play about it, a doco about the event. And there were some similar clashes here in Australia and in New Zealand. And these clashes heralded violent battles that are still evident in the US today. And we can infer from such clashes about race, if you like, that there are more troubling boundaries between people, for example, race, than there are boundaries between the different gens that we've been talking about today.
So much that we can unpack. And I think, you know, you have highlighted a lot in terms of, yes, the generations and some of the cautions we need to take about to kind of really think about some of the other social factors that might be impacting how we interact with each other, how we engage, how we work. So thank you so much, Greg, for coming on our podcast and sharing all of this wisdom. And yeah, we've learned so much from you. So thank you. Hi everyone, it's Dash. Thanks for taking the time to listen to the XYZ Experiment podcast, and don't forget to leave a rating and a review. If you've enjoyed our show and like what you're hearing, tell all your friends and family and hit that subscribe button. If you want to hear our updates and know when episodes drop, follow us on Instagram at the XYZ Experiment for all the latest updates and news. And our original music was composed and performed by the amazing Luke Champion.